Okay, so by way of introduction, remind you that the standard model dating from Weinberg's theory of leptons is now more than 35 years old. And its essential goal, which was to describe electric symmetry breaking, spontaneously broken gauge theory, is spectacularly confirmed. A lot of the great things that went into it, are also, by this time, rather rather old. It was known to be renormalizable. Discovery of neutral currents are 30 years old now. The W and Z bosons are 20 years old. And we're just finishing up the great run at LEP and SLAC to study the precision properties of W and Z's. And yet, the essential element, the agent of the electroweak symmetry breaking, has still not been seen. And that is the great question in electroweak physics, is where is the Higgs? So in this talk, I will focus primarily on the LHC. You just heard in the previous talk the prospects for Higgs searches at the Tevatron. I might mention at the end, if there's time, some of the possibilities at a linear collider, but I will be concentrating on the near future, because that is at the Tevatron, but the pretty near future at the LHC. And so what is the Higgs boson? The minimal standard model, electric symmetry breaking, is accomplished by a single complex scalar doublet, which gives mass to the W and Z bosons, and a single scalar field is left over called the Higgs boson. And this Higgs is also, Higgs multiplet is also responsible for giving mass to the quarks and the leptons. In a supersymmetric model, there must be at least two such doublets, and there are at least five physical particles left over after symmetry breaking. So where is the Higgs? Well, a priori, the mass is a free parameter. Nonetheless, we can constrain it by various theoretical prejudices, which I'll go into, we can make precision measurements. And any precision measurement, of course, is only as good as the model which you use, which you test against the precision measurements. And you can then have experimental search limits. And the only real hole in an experimental search limit is if it manages to decay in some way that your detector is not sensitive to. But nonetheless, this is really puts the only really hard limits we have on the Higgs. So the three primary considerations for theoretical prejudices go by the name of vacuum stability, triviality, and unitarity. And I just remembered that I have the fancy laser pointer now, so. And by this I mean partial wave unitarity. Now, vacuum stability is the notion that we live in the true vacuum, or the true ground state of the electroweak potential. Some people are satisfied with metastability, which means that we live in a well of the potential, but not the absolute minimum, but that the tunneling lifetime of our universe is longer than the age of the universe. So we're safe for now. Triviality is the idea, or reflects the fact that the Higgs self-coupling is unstable under higher order corrections, and that it grows as you perform higher and higher order corrections, and that the only stable solution is one where the coupling is in fact zero, and therefore it is a free or trivial theory. Those bounds are summarized on this plot here. The way to read this is the Higgs mass on that axis, and over here on this axis is the scale at which new physics must enter in order to save the standard model from failure due to either in vacuum instability or triviality, where triviality is based on how large you're willing to allow the coupling to grow. It's quite provocative that this region slightly above the LEP mass limit, up to about 180 GeV, the standard model is quite happy and does not need to be rescued by new physics. The other consideration is partial wave unitarity, which involves the scattering of longitudinal W bosons, W's and Z's. Those amplitudes would grow with energy until they're cut off by the Higgs mass. Now they would not saturate unitarity unless the Higgs mass is above 800, 900 GeV, in which case it's entering a strong coupling regime, and such models are overlap with dynamical symmetry breaking models. There are supersymmetric constraints. In order to fit in the MH max scenario, is that for every value of the pseudoscalar mass in tan beta, you find the largest mass for the lightest scalar. And with this, you find a maximum limit of about 135 GeV. A few years ago, people were saying it was closer to 125. As two loop corrections to the Higgs mass have been imposed, it's crept up to 135. There's been much talk about the fact that the top mass could creep upward, in which case this limit will go up. If the top mass goes up by 5 GeV or 1 sigma, the limit on the Higgs mass goes up as well. The direct search limits and precision constraints within the standard model. The direct search limit is 114.4 GeV with a hint of a signal that's around 116. Put that into precision fits, demanding the standard model, and you get a best fit of 96 GeV. It's a rather broad minimum. 95% confidence level extends up to 219. The blue bands have been shifting over the years. They all look the same because of the color scheme and such, but in fact, they have been moving around. Just 3 years ago, the best fit was at 60 GeV. And while the 95% exclusion limit has not changed dramatically, it's the best fit has gone up by 50%. And and so it really does move around a bit, but it just reflects that this is a rather broad minimum, and that it's logarithmically dependent on the Higgs mass. Much talk about the NUTEV result. Its main influence is to make the parabola broader rather than to actually change the fit or change the best value of the fit. You'll notice that this plot goes up to 1,000 and this plot goes to 400. That's what I download off the LEP Electric Working Group page, so I'm not responsible for the change in scale. But some of the parameters that go into these fits are more equal than others. For instance, two of the most interesting and two that have moved in recent years are the W mass and the top mass. And you see that one sigma changes in either of these brings you closer to the unexcluded region of the Higgs. And since the Higgs is varying logarithmically on here, it really makes a big difference as to whether these values move or not. So what if MT moves? This has been discussed many times. The minimum is broad. And Darian Wood showed that D0 has a new top mass from run 1 data of 180 GeV. I don't have a plot for exactly that mass, but if we just do the shift to 179, you find that the best fit is now above the exclusion region of 126, and that the 95% confidence level limit is now 283. So this is not a published result. It would have to be averaged with the other published results, so it's not going to jump all the way out to here. But these fits change a lot, so you can't just go on the basis of current best fits and limit your searches on them, because there's really too much play left in them, even with all the great measurements that have been put into them. The Susie-Higgs limit. There's two important parameters for the Susie-Higgs sector, two very important parameters, the mass of the pseudoscalar and tangent beta. And here you find that the Higgs can actually evade the standard model search limit if the pseudoscalar is as light as it can be. And you can actually get the lightest Higgs does not behave very much like a standard model Higgs. That's another view of the limits on pseudoscalar. This is a different parameterization of the same data on the of the Higgs. Here, the lightest Higgs is standard model-like, and therefore it respects the LEP bounds. In this region here, it clearly cannot be standard model-like because it evades the LEP bounds, the 114 GeV bound. Notice the tan beta exclusion region. This is theoretically inaccessible, is what they say, and that's that same plot that I showed you earlier. That's these curves coming down here. Now, the previous plot I showed was based on the old fit, the two loop corrections to the Higgs mass weaken the exclusion by and large. The one sigma shift in the top mass removes the exclusion. Right? A few years ago, we said tan beta had to be greater than 2.1, 2.3, something of that nature. Now, but that's a weak statement, because a one sigma shift in the top mass measurement completely removes that exclusion. Okay, so those are the things to keep in mind when looking for the Higgs, is that we really don't know where it is, except that the only really solid bound we have is the LEP exclusion, not these precision fits, because there's still too much play left in them because of the nature of the uncertainties. Higgs production at the LHC, there are three really important channels: gluon fusion to Higgs. This is the W boson fusion, where two incoming quarks radiate W's, which interact to produce a Higgs. And the TT bar Higgs is this purple line. The cross section is rather small for this, but it's a rather spectacular signal to have all that hadronic energy coming out. The branching ratios. If you're below the WW threshold, there's a rich structure in branching ratios, and you might be able to measure. Certainly, the linear collider, you can measure several of these. Even at the LHC, you can get a handle on a number of them. Once you go above the WW threshold, all of these modes get heavily suppressed. And only if the Higgs is really quite heavy can you measure anything but the W and Z with any reasonable precision. These become rare decays. Also, at the very lowest end, the B branching ratio dominates, but these are, for the most part, overwhelmed. B decays are overwhelmed by the QCD background. So this is a plot of the various search strategies. At the lowest energies, you can use TT bar H. This is the famous Higgs to gamma-gamma decay, which at 30 inverse femtobarns does not quite make it up to the 5 sigma level. This plot does not show any W boson fusion channels, but certainly once you get around 140 or so, the Higgs to WW and Higgs to ZZ, or off-shell, picks up and you get very, very strong signals. Now this is a little, well, it may be realistic, but it's pessimistic in the fact that, in the sense that there's no k-factors here. And as you'll show, the k-factor for gluon fusion is very large. So it's really making this channel, you know, play with one hand tied behind its back. Whereas the others are more optimistic. The corrections are not terribly large on any of these others. Well, this is gluon fusion, but it's already a 20 sigma signal at 30 inverse femtobarns, so we're not, won't complain about undercounting there. So gluon fusion dominates Higgs production, and this at face seems rather curious that an electroweak object like the Higgs that couples to mass is its production is dominated by massless gauge bosons of QCD. The answer is, of course, that it goes through a top loop. This presents a problem for the theorist because the very simplest process we can compute is a top loop. Okay, a triangle is not so hard, but it quickly gets much, much worse. So luckily there is an effective theory. You can form an operator product expansion. There is one dimension 5 operator. But when you integrate out the top quark, this Wilson coefficient has been computed to very high order, higher even than needed for next-to-next deleting order. And by using the effective Lagrangian, you're able to take a tree-level diagram, one-loop diagram into a trivial vertex diagram. And then you can do radiative corrections much more easily. In spite of the difficulty, next-deleting order calculations have been done in the full theory, and of course in the effective theory. And the agreement is remarkable. You can see that I've cheated because my effective theory has a top threshold, which of course, since I've integrated out the top, it cannot have. What I've done is I've used the effective theory to compute essentially a K factor, a correction factor. I say it tells me the magnitude of the radiative corrections, and then I weight it with the leading order cross section. And it works extremely well, and this is not an accident. As I'll show in results, even at next-to-next deleting order, or it becomes even more apparent at that order, that the corrections are dominated by soft emission, or infrared emission, and that just doesn't resolve the top quark within the loop. And so getting this K-factor from the effective theory works well in the inclusive production channel. So why do we want next to leading order? Well, at next to leading order, we had a problem that the correction was of order 80% or more. And the uncertainty band from scale dependence actually grew. It got worse than at leading order. So there were questions of, do we understand this process? What's going to happen at the next order? Is it going to be another step or another doubling? Or how do we proceed? Do we just, for many years, we just took the NLO calculation because that was the best we could do. There was nothing wrong with the calculation. That was just the answer. But we'd like to understand the process better. In recent years, we have. It's been computed in the effective theory to next to leading order by three different groups using rather different methods. Actually, Harlander and I used very similar methods to Ravinder and Smith and Van Nerven. And basically, we use Feynman diagram techniques to compute the amplitudes, square them, and integrate over phase space. The difference was that Van Nerven and company had an integral table dating from the Drell-Yan days, and they were simply able to do the double real emission integrals based on work Willie had done years ago. They only had to do a few new integrals. Harlander and I were faced with the prospect of doing several hundred new integrals, and instead developed a technique of expanding around the threshold. And by taking the first 78 moments around the threshold, we were able to then invert that result into a functional form. The most radical difference was this technique of Anastasio and Melnikov. And essentially, they just take they use the Kutkosky rules, where you cut a loop diagram, put these particles on shell, and then use a very clever idea that the delta function, which enforces the on shell condition for the Higgs, is converted into a difference of propagators, or perhaps as David would call it, a propagator and a quasi-propagator. And then this whole thing is put into the machinery that was developed to compute the two-loop amplitudes, two-to-two scattering amplitudes that Tomas talked about earlier. And this works very well and allows them to obtain the whole answer. And as I'll talk about in a little bit, it has possibilities for further extensions in actually computing distributions. Well, this is a piece of the answer. And I say all groups agree exactly. This is not like two next to leading order jet calculations where you take the programs, you compute distributions, and then you compare them bin by bin. This is exact analytic agreement down to the coefficient of every trilogarithm and log cubed x term. And this relies as much on a computer as the calculation itself. I was able to download their paper, Anastasio Melnikov's paper off the net, get the tech source, turn tech into form program, and compare it to the moments I had extracted and the inversion of the moments, and find that we agree exactly down to every last coefficient. So this, it's not agreement within a percent. It's exact agreement. And this is the result. We take our exact agreement, and then we have to smear them over partons. So then, after that, I can't say that our curves are exactly right, because we have to agree on a lot of other things. But the basic result is that it's a modest correction. It's not small. It's of order 15%. But it's not 80%. And it's very satisfying. The perturbation theory really seems to be working. And it really brings theoretical control to this process. The scale dependence is still rather large. It's smaller than at next to leading order, but it's really back down to it's plus minus 10 to 15%. Here I've chosen to vary the scales in such a way as to maximize this band, but it doesn't get a lot smaller even if I choose to vary them at the same direction. Now, once you have all these other terms, you can then perform a threshold resummation. You can extract coefficients from the soft and virtual pieces. And Catani and company have done this. And guide your eye, here is the central value of this, of next to next leading order is 2, whereas this is the 2 is the bottom of the band here. So they don't agree exactly. There is a slight enhancement from the resummation. But this really brings some weight to the argument that that agreement between the effective theory and the full theory is not an accident. It's really completely dominated by these by the soft emission. And the resummation of the soft emission is really giving you perhaps the most reliable answer. And it also tells you that there's not much more to be gained from higher orders. You're not going to see another big step. The convergence of the perturbation theory is also real, and we expect that this is a legitimate error band, even for higher order calculations. At the Tevatron, here you see at the Tevatron, the K-factor is 3 or more. Unfortunately, you can't use this mode at the Tevatron except right around the W threshold, because there's not enough luminosity to use any decay other than into B pairs, and the B pairs are completely overwhelmed by the QCD background. We can look forward to Higgs distributions at next to leading order. Using this cutting method, these distributions can be computed. Essentially, you put in a cut on the rapidity, phrase that as a delta function, use the same trick that they used in the Kutkowski rules, turn the delta function into a difference of propagators, and put it into this same machinery. Maybe you have to learn a few new integrals, but it's the same basic machinery, and it works beautifully. They have recently produced, this group has recently produced, NLL distributions for Drell-Yan. So far, there's next to leading order for the Higgs, but I'm sure there's actually data for Drell-Yan, so that, of course, is the more important one to produce first, but I'm sure we'll see this distribution for the Higgs before too long. I think that's a really great development and very promising for future promise. Now, the next thing to look at is the Higgs at finite transverse momentum. Both signal identification as well as the signal background can be improved by looking at Higgs production at finite transverse momentum. In the effective theory, this has been computed next to leading order by three different groups. The background process for Higgs decay into gamma-gamma has also been computed at next to leading order. And both of these have very large K factors, so you don't really get a better signal to background ratio going to next to leading order. You might have hoped that the background wouldn't grow as much, but it does. Nonetheless, the signal significance is probably is quite similar. And since you have more handles on this kind of signal than you have an inclusive production, so it's really this is just the beginning of this story of using this to try to extract the signal from this background. Once you have this at next to leading order, you can then resum the Higgs transverse momentum. You can either resum just the transverse momentum, done by Berger and Chu and Catanian collaborators again, or you can do what's called a joint resummation, where you combine this with a threshold resummation, as George mentioned briefly yesterday. You do this. You can do this resummation. You see, next to leading order has a divergence down at very low QT, because that's beyond the range of validity for next to leading order. More interesting is that there's a significant enhancement in hard momentums, relatively hard momenta. This is Higgs of 125 GeV. Even at 50 to 75 GeV, there's significantly higher transverse momenta Higgs from the resummation than from a straight next to leading order calculation. And at worst, this difference is a little bigger than the residual uncertainty in the next to leading order, in the next to leading log calculation. The joint resummation puts yet another twist on this. I don't know that it's necessarily a narrowing of the spectrum, because there's a normalization difference, which George can discuss more coherently than I, so I'll leave it to him. But still, these are issues that are still being resolved, and I think could be important for signals at the LHC. Look now at supersymmetric Higgs boson production. As I said before, there are two Higgs doublets, two vacuum expectation values, and five physical Higgs scalars. Now, in the decoupling limit, the lightest neutral scalar has properties very much like the standard model Higgs. So mainly I will, for this next section, I'll focus on the heavy Higgs and the pseudoscalar, which have rather different interactions. So finding the Suzy Higgs at LHC. This is a very complicated plot, and it doesn't even say the half of it, because it's there are many, many different search modes. And right, the light Higgs, or the standard model-like Higgs, the light Higgs is all down here below 135 or so. Maybe 140 if you like a heavy top mass. All the rest of this plot is devoted to the heavy Higgs and the pseudoscalar. And as the pseudoscalar gets very, very heavy, then the pseudoscalar and the Higgs have essentially the same properties, other than strength of couplings and also the same mass, even. I'd like to remind you that we will likely see superpartners first, right? Because as Ian showed this, 1 week of LHC, low luminosity data, exceeds the Fermilab reach. A month dominates the most interesting part of the phase space. Now, that doesn't mean that by August 2007 we're going to know that we have supersymmetric Higgs, but these are going to be among the first signals pulled out, certainly before the Higgs signals are pulled out. The Higgs are, especially at low mass, are challenging signals, and they're going to take a lot of work. Whereas once the detectors are understood well enough to produce any results, we're going to have significant results on supersymmetry. So we will know that we're looking for a supersymmetric Higgs by the time we have enough luminosity to look for a supersymmetric Higgs. Pseudoscalar production, gluon fusion is also very important for this, at least at low tan beta. And you can also formulate an effective Lagrangian for this with the top integrated out. In this case, there's actually two dimension 5 operators, but the second only appears at next to next to leading order and makes a very small contribution. again, you get the same simplification. This was also computed in the full theory to next to leading order. Recent, last couple of years, NNLO production, pseudoscalar production was done the same as scalar production by the usual suspects. And once again, obtaining exact analytic agreement. In fact, the results are remarkably similar to the scalar Higgs, even though the interaction itself is rather different. If you want to get into delving into SUSY models, you can then start adding Squark and Gluon effects, but they're very dependent on the masses chosen of both particles. That's recent work on this by Harlinger and Steinhauser. The result looks a lot like the scalar Higgs result, as you might expect. It's whereas there was a very large enhancement at next to leading order, the NNLO correction is rather modest. Here we've set the top Yukawa coupling to its standard model value. In fact, as tan beta goes up, this Yukawa coupling will go down. So this brings me to this problem, is that this effective theory for pseudoscalar production only works at low tan beta, where you can ignore the B quark couplings, because you can't integrate out a B quark when you're producing a Higgs boson at more than 100 GeV. And so you need to do an honest NNLO calculation would require massive three-loop diagrams. Okay, now it's a vertex diagram. You need massive two-loop diagrams, which Tomas said people were working on. But that's a far, far more significant undertaking than using the effective theory. However, right, in the if life gives you lemons, make lemonade point of view, we can make use of this strong B coupling at large tan beta and actually look at a different production mechanism, namely B quark fusion. Now, since the Bs in a parton distribution are generated by gluon splitting, you can argue that the true parent process is glu-glu goes to BB bar H, where you simply don't observe the other Bs in this production. While there's certainly some validity in that, there are great benefits to using a B quark distribution. Namely, it resums the large logs associated with collinear splitting, forward splitting of the gluons. However, I would say that doing this, you only have a consistent and stable result if you calculate the high enough order to include the parent process, because you're just, you might be able, you can find a scale which agrees pretty well, but you've clearly left something out if you just take BB bar to H at leading order. You don't know, you've left out a big chunk of the physics that's going on. At next to next to leading order, this is actually part of the real corrections to the to the process, and therefore we believe we will get a stable answer or a reliable answer at that order. Now, in order to do the calculation, you have to ignore the B quark mass. It must be ignored in the initial state, or you violate the factorization theorem. And in the final state, you can ignore it because the effects are suppressed by the ratio of the mass squared over the Higgs mass squared. And when you find you go to this m goes to zero limit, the production amplitudes for these are exactly the same. And this is just because massless Bs have a chiral symmetry and they can't tell the difference between a scalar and a pseudoscalar. And this process can dominate at large tan beta because while it's suppressed by the B quark mass in the Yukawa coupling, it's enhanced by tan beta. Whereas the gluon fusion mechanism, even if I include B quark somehow, is going to have something which, this is the top quark part squared, it's suppressed by tan beta squared. The interference of top quark and B quark amplitudes is suppressed by MB squared. There's logs of MBs, but it doesn't change the power counting. It's just a log enhancement. And the pure B quark contribution is tan beta enhanced, but it's suppressed by MB to the fourth. So at large tan beta, this term can dominate. Before I show you how it dominates, let me show the results of the NNLO calculation in the sense vastly improved scale dependence. Down here, the scale dependence is quite strong, but you're getting down to a scale of 12 GeV with a 5 GeV B quark. So you worry about the power corrections in the B parton distribution. Once you're at high, once you're at a reasonable mass, those are all washed away, and it's just the regular logarithmic evolution, and you have very nice scale dependence. Much better than at lower order. Same story for the renormalization scale dependence, very flat, and except you get some bad behavior as you get near the B quark mass. But that's understood, and there's no reason when you're looking at Higgs production you should be particularly near the B quark mass in there. So at small tan beta, say tan beta of 1, the B quark, B fusion component is very tiny and is not useful at all. However, by tan beta of 10, it dominates. And at the crossover point is between tan beta of 5 and 7. This is where I've tried to estimate the B component, or even if I just use next to leading order, since I can't do an honest calculation of the B contribution, it agrees pretty well in here. But this red line is the B quark fusion component, and it it dominates for reasonably large tan beta. You see people do calculations where they say with a straight face that tan beta is 35 and such, in which case the B quark fusion is vastly dominant over any other production mechanism. You can compare this to the gluon fusion process at next to leading order, and here you don't get the log enhancement from the collinear evolution of the B parton distribution, but you do get a piece of the extra contribution from the next to leading order. And you see that the B quark fusion is significantly larger than the gluon fusion contribution, but it really gives this and the stability of the result at next to next leading order really give weight to the idea of using B parton distributions, and though it has been controversial in recent years, that seems to be largely settled as of last summer's Lazouch conference. There were long discussions there. So where would this be useful? Go back to this plot. It's useful at large tan beta. So these are the two most likely prospects. Now, to actually see taus, you probably need the Higgs to have some transverse momentum in order to reconstruct the taus. But still, it's a prospect gives you a vastly greater signal than was used for this to generate this plot. And the muons also have a tan beta enhanced decay. So you can certainly lower, should be able to lower this search limit significantly to lower tan beta. Perhaps more phenomenologically useful is using a single B parton in the initial state. This was done, so you're looking at Higgs plus B quark production, where you tag a single B, but not two Bs. recently done by Campbell, Ellis, and company. And you find that you get a modest enhancement over leading order, right? You don't get a large enhancement like you did at top in gluon fusion, even in the inclusive production, but it's a relatively modest enhancement, but it's vastly larger than trying to tag on two Bs, which is required for the gluon fusion to BB bar H. And again, they find very nice improvement in the scale dependence at this by going, since they only have one B in the initial state, in a lowest efficient to obtain a reliable result and remove the unphysical scale dependence or the unphysicality of using a B parton at too low an order. how am I doing? TT bar H production has recently been computed at next to leading order by two different groups. This process serves as a discovery mode for the lightest lightest Higgs masses, perhaps has a stronger signal than the gluon fusion and decay through to photons. And it also should give information on the top Yukawa coupling to measure this process. Weak boson fusion is yet another process. Nanolow corrections have been known for some time, and they're rather modest. They were recently implemented in a multipurpose Monte Carlo. And that's very important because these are complicated processes. In order to make use of this, you need to tag the leftover quarks, which are generally forward jets. You need to veto against stray jets in the central part of the calorimeter, or the central part of the detector, where you want the Higgs to decay. It offers good discovery potential within the intermediate mass range. It wasn't on the plot I showed earlier, but I'll show you that in a second. And you might worry about the pure QCD background. This has been computed in the full theory and found to be rather modest within the set of cuts that will enhance the signal. What you would do to remove ordinary QCD processes, even the irreducible background is also strongly reduced in those regions. So there's actually a number of channels you can look at in here. Here the decay through WW star is higher even than the ZZ star and WW star production through gluon fusion throughout this mass range. Eventually the ZZ mode takes over. But it greatly improves the viability of the signal in the intermediate mass range over other channels. It can also be used to do some level of precision measurements at the LHC. That's normally a domain assumed to be left to the linear collider, but you don't do too badly it depends on how ambitious your goals are. You can hope to measure signal times branching ratio to a few percent in the W boson fusion mode, decays to two Ws, and even at 10 to 20% in most of the weak boson fusion modes that you can actually detect. And so you do a reasonable job with that. You try to convert that into a measure of the absolute couplings, and okay, it's not a precision measurement. 80% is not a precision measurement at low luminosity, but it gets down to within 25% over a broad range at very high luminosity. And if the Higgs is massive, you have fewer channels you can look at, but you can actually measure them quite well. So my summary for the LHC program in Higgs search is that we're well positioned to discover the Higgs at the LHC. Some signals will take years of running to develop, but we really know how to attack these problems, and I think we're doing well there. We will be able to measure couplings and branching ratios with reasonable precision, but hadronic uncertainties, both in detection and in the production cross-section, we simply can't compute the gluon fusion cross-section better than 10% at level. That limits the precision that we can hope to obtain in extracting these parameters. Just to say a little bit about the linear collider is that while we can do a lot of great things at the LHC to really make precision measurements of the Higgs and understand the Higgs sector, we will want to go to a linear collider and just flash a few brief plots that show the extraordinary precision that can be obtained. The linear collider could have been a discovery machine, but I think by the time it gets built, the LHC will have seen such a Higgs such as this. But it can make fantastic measurements of the couplings. Here, these bands are the theoretical uncertainty on how big those couplings should be, or actually, it's branching ratios. And the points are the expected error bars at a linear collider. In many cases, the error bars are smaller than the theoretical uncertainty bands. It's really extraordinary measurements. Of course, you have to be in the range where the branching ratios are large enough to be measured. But if the Higgs is not too heavy, then this is can make great measurements. And even if the Higgs is heavier than that, it will make very precise measurements of the decays that it is able to measure. It can do very clean separation of the spin and CP quantum numbers, which of course you want to do to verify that it is a scalar Higgs boson. You can detect the spin, separate the spin very easily, and you can separate scalar from pseudoscalar very easily. So my summary is there's been great progress in Higgs physics over the last few years. Inclusive production is known at next-to-next leading order, both at in the standard model ends and the supersymmetric standard model. Distributions at NNLO are coming and look to be very promising. B-quark distributions have been established as a consistent way to approach the problem of supersymmetric Higgs boson production. The interesting associated production processes are all known at next to leading order, and the backgrounds are all known next to leading order. And so what do we still need here? Well, what I didn't mention is that Higgs plus jet production, when done in the effective theory for that in those calculations, breaks down when the Higgs or the transverse momentum of the Higgs approach the top mass. And so they're not effective in that region. It would be very nice for this signal to actually have a full Higgs plus jet next to leading order in the full theory. Now, this requires massive two-loop box diagrams, which Tomas says are coming. I don't underestimate the amount of work involved in that, but that's on a wish list. It's not going to happen next week, but I think that would be a real improvement to our theoretical tools of analyzing the Higgs. A next to leading order Monte Carlo calculations. David believes that they will happen within this year. I'm not quite so optimistic. I would settle for the less ambitious goal of perhaps using time at this workshop to use Drell-Yan and Higgs, the relatively simple processes. Perhaps we can just beat them into the ground and solve them and actually learn something that we can use for the general purpose algorithms that will be implemented for jet production and those signals. I think now that we have this next to leading order calculation for weak boson fusion, we really need to study the viability of these processes and see if put them into detector simulations and see if we can really make these measurements. And a lot of work has gone into establishing them as interesting things to look at, but actually turning them into signals to be searched for is still requires a bit of work. And finally, this could help the Tevatron as well, is signal recognition. So far, we're relying on a few clean channels. Can we find some way of recognizing, perhaps using energy flow algorithms, of recognizing massive color singlets like the Higgs or W's or W prime, something of that sort, more effectively than traditional JET algorithms and therefore enhance signal measurements. Okay. That's all I have to say.
So question, comments?
Bill, I want to underscore the second bullet that you have in your conclusion and to really make an appeal to the community. I think that this idea that many are pursuing, which is to get a general framework to be able to do the next-to-next reading order Monte Carlos, is a losing starting point. One should really sit down, take the only process which, to first approximation, we really need to know at next-to-next reading order, which is the Brillouin, because that's going to be used as a luminometer, and there we do want 1%, and exploit the fact that indeed it's much, much simpler than anything else, and beat it to death, as you said, and get it done. And it would be more rewarding than anything else, than, you know, waiting 10 years to have a general framework. So yes. Really, it should be done. I really beg people to take this simplistic viewpoint and take all of the shortcuts made possible, but
yes, my phrasing of that point is influenced by our discussion at dinner the other night. But we all want next-to-next leading Monte Carlo calculations, but I think that it's a good idea to just do the simplest one we can as quickly as we can, and we'll learn a lot that will then be useful for a more general algorithm. That once you have a general algorithm, you're still going to have to work out all the details of implementing it effectively. So I think that's a fruitful direction.
I just had a quick comment. The first QT resummation that I know of for Higgs was Balash and Yuan and Rezbas, and that's still the only one that's really accessible to experimentalists.
Okay, I'll have to check the reference on that. I didn't. Sorry, I don't have it.
In the process where you've got Higgs in association with BB bar, you know, either the BB bar goes to H or the GG goes to H BB bar. Presumably, in every one of those events, there are predominantly forward-moving B and B bar.
Yes.
Has anybody worked out how many of those Bs and B bars would be observable? In other words, within the kinematics that they could be detected.
Not to my knowledge. I mean, and that's one of the problems, certainly with the BB bar annihilation, is that you don't know what happened to the. Presumably, each B was produced by gluon splitting, and you don't know what happened to the other half of that splitting, and therefore you are in principle not allowed to look and tag on Bs, when you're trying to examine such a process. You know, you just have to take them if they come, but you can't tag on them to enhance your signal because you've ignored the origin of the Bs that you use for your luminosity. That's why I focused on tau decays or mu decays. You know, in principle, you know, it should decay. The B decay should be strongly enhanced at large hand beta. But the problem with that is you don't. If you only demand the two B tags of the Higgs, there are stray Bs that came from that primary splitting, and I don't know how to handle that properly, and make use of that framework and within that framework.
Any further question? If not, let's take.